This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action with host Arman Shrocki. Each week, Arman will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curve.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. I'm here with my special guest this week, Dan, and I would like for him to introduce himself, please, and give us a little bit of also introduction to what he does.
Hey, my name is Dan Balkowski. Great to be here with you, Arman, and I am the founder and chief pricing officer of a consulting firm down here in Austin, Texas, which found out that you're based here as well. I've been down here about 20 years, but my entire 20-year career in software. These days, at Product Tranquility, we focus on helping high-volume B2B SaaS CEOs define pricing and packaging for new products. But as I mentioned, I've been in my software my entire career and started more on the value creation side than the value capture side, started as an engineer writing code. Ultimately, I became much more fascinated by how our products created customer value and turned into dollars and cents for the business. This led me to pursue an MBA. I didn't realize it at the time, but was quite lucky with my choice of schools. The program I went to is widely recognized for excellence in marketing, but I didn't find out till very recently, very few MBA programs have courses in pricing. So I got my theoretical grounding in pricing there and got thrown into the real world side of it with the internship I did for a very successful Silicon Valley company at the time, where they asked me to spend some time looking at if they should pursue a freemium approach. We might come back to this later, but TLDR, do not recommend freemium for any of your listeners. Generally does not work out well. And you know, afterwards, spend a lot of time in the product management, product strategy world. And now all I do is help founder CEOs and their teams build sustainable businesses by helping them get the right pricing and packaging for their products.
Fantastic. And what do they... Normally, pricing is a very sensitive matter. So I wonder, during the course of the work that you have done, what's your take? What do they normally people get wrong about price?
Yeah, so I think the first thing, it depends how much time we have, because my list of things they get wrong could be quite long. But I think the number one thing I see time and again is when it comes to SaaS pricing, most executives think that what you charge determines your success. In fact, who and how you charge determines your success. I can't tell you the number of conversations that start with, hey, we're trying to figure out what to price this product. Is it, you know, $19 a user? Is it $99 a user? Is it $29.95? Should I price it to end in fives or nines? And look, I love those conversations. They're super fun and interesting, but they're totally focused in the wrong area. That would be what we call the price level. Much more important is who you're charging, what's the ideal customer set that you're going after, because there's no average customer, there's no average value. Everyone has a very specific context and therefore will value your product differently. So you have to be very clear on who you're going after. Who are we pricing for? You should never ask what is the right price, but it's like, what is the right price for who? If you don't fully complete that sentence, the question is somewhat meaningless. And then how we charge. So this would be all the elements of packaging that we may get into. But, you know, my general advice is, you know, I would spend most of my time on what the price tag goes on, and much less, if no time, on what number actually goes on the price tag.
And do you think people really, when I say people, I mean organizations and the management team and CEOs, are spending enough time and attention on pricing? Or you think in general, you know, that's the problem, that most CEOs may not really look at the pricing as often as they should?
Absolutely not. The monetization, I've often said this, there's only three ways to grow a SaaS company: acquisition, retention, monetization. Acquisition gets all the play. And I think over and above retention and monetization for sure. And I think that may be shifting a little bit with the macro environment where folks are realizing that some of the net new acquisition is tapped out. We're not being getting brand new marketing channels every year like we were for a period there. And as well, it's just in a more of a macro recessionary environment. We'll see what happens. It's hard to forecast the future. That's kind of what it feels like right now. New business is hard to come by. So in that case, people maybe shift a little bit more to retention. Let's keep the customers we have because they're much more important. And then monetization is often looked at as this black box magic voodoo. And there's many reasons for that. I think there's a misperception that pricing and packaging, and I'll often say just pricing, but refer to pricing and packaging, but that gets awkward. So just to make it simpler for your audience, there's an aspect where people believe monetization or pricing is this art. Well, it's an art and a science, but it's much more science than it is art. Mm-hmm. You need both. We need the elements of understanding economic theory and how people make decisions. But then also there's aspects of psychology, and we know this as good marketers. So just in general, also, I think the problem is that it tends to poor pricing is not as obvious on the P&L as other aspects. You know, the COO every month gets a bill from AWS that tells them how much they've spent on their cloud infrastructure, and they get a bill from every other vendor, and they go, the COO runs over to the CTO or head of engineering, says, oh my God, like, we got to get this price down because this is how much, you know, we're paying. You know, we cut our spend 50%. Now, that will get all of the attention in the room. But what's not showing up on the P&L is, you know, bring it back to what I was talking about before. Let's say you are charging $20 per seat, but you should be charging $200 per seat. Well, that, you know, 9x of revenue that you should be appearing, no one's getting a bill on their desk saying you missed out on all this revenue this month because you're massively underpriced. So it's this invisible sort of opportunity cost. And as humans, you know, we tend to bias on availability and recency. What is our, you know, at most prescient at our fingertips? What do we have evidence for? And so I think because there's this element of it feels like it's just guessing anyway, which is not true. And it's sort of out of sight, out of mind, and all the attention is going to, well, let's just acquire more customers because we'll acquire all the customers, then X, and then profit. You know, we'll all be successful, right? With that logic, is it really thought through? I think that's a lot of the reasons why monetization tends to get ignored.
Yeah, and innovation normally is kind of related, or is kind of, you know, people think about innovation, they normally think about product. But I can tell you by my experience that actually innovation, the same way, can apply to pricing, licensing, packaging as well. So you can be very innovative in those aspects as much as you can be innovative in the kind of product and functionalities that you can bring to the market. So definitely that's another area of innovation when people wanted to think about it. But when you go to these companies and you look at them and you see something like this is the perfect pricing, how do you define that kind of perfect pricing from your perspective? What kind of attributes you look at to see if this pricing is really good or not?
Well, I don't know if perfect pricing exists in the universe. I don't think I've seen it yet. Pricing is a journey. It's a process. It's not an event. There is no... and also, I don't know who the arbiter of that perfect pricing would be. I think there's a couple of ways I think about what effective pricing looks like. So ultimately, with effective pricing, and again, I use this to encompass all of pricing and packaging, but an effective price really helps you capture fair value for the value you deliver to customers and maximizes your company's long-term profitability. Long-term, you know, the value is in the eye of the beholder, right? So long-term for a Fortune 100 company, they may be thinking about a 10-year time frame or more, whereas your startup that's worried about making payroll this quarter might have a much shorter long-term. So, but that being said, right, we still hold that, you know, are we creating a fair exchange of value. And one of the ways philosophically to think about price is it's really how a buyer and a seller divide value in a transaction. We're going to create 10 units of value. I'm going to take one of those units as the seller. I'm going to give you 9 and you feel happy in that transaction, right? So this is one way we think about pricing. Ultimately, I think there's a couple of characteristics about good pricing. So one is that it's fair. 2, it's consistent. And 3, it's transparent. And I will say that generally, I really dislike the idea of A-B testing pricing, especially in B2B. This is one of these areas where the B2C concepts are brought over into B2B and are just a terrible idea. You're going to have a bad time. Because if we think about those principles of fair, consistent, and transparent, A-B testing pricing in a B2B scenario violates all 3 of those fundamental good principles of good pricing. But what do I mean by fair? So price and value are in line. We share value in a balanced way. It's not a zero-sum game where I win, you lose. Ultimately, the cardinal rule of fairness is don't increase your profit at my expense. And I was just reading a really good book talking all about pricing and fairness, and very interesting the different ways that we process fairness as a society. You know, a lot of it is, what have we traditionally done? There's not, if we go to a restaurant in the US, they bring us free water and put bread on the table, right? Whereas maybe I go to a restaurant in Europe and maybe they put the bread on the table. If I eat the bread, I get charged for it, which that would never happen in the US, or, you know, I have to pay for the tap water at the table, right? So it's just what is traditionally done is what we all accept as fair. And then, you know, as we see with things like what just happened with Reddit, their change to API pricing. If the people we are serving, in this case, customers, but they have multiple communities they're serving, which is their moderators as well, if they don't perceive it as fair, you can have a outsized negative reaction where people are just like, well, you know, go to extreme lengths. Anyone's taking a look at the Reddit saga, you know, the moderators basically fully boycotted and made their communities private. So it's been a big mess when you don't execute pricing in a fair way. So the other thing is, we'll talk about consistency. You know, across time, it's consistent, and across different customer segments. And then transparency, you know, it's clear how we set prices, right? And I think one of the examples that have cropped up recently where this principle has been violated and the company's actually taking it on directly has been Airbnb and their cleaning fees, where you go and you search for a place to stay for you and your family for a trip, whatever it might be. And you look at the prices of places, they're like, oh, okay, this place looks great. And then you go to like look at, okay, for the 5-day trip, it's going to be there. Oh, it's going to be double what I expected because there's a, you know, $200 cleaning fee, right? So it violates people's notion of transparency. And so then companies can really get in trouble that way. So I think those kind of fundamental principles and ultimately, right, are we aligned on the long-term profitability of the company, or when I see good pricing, they meet those criteria.
And some people have told me that the best pricing they ever came up with was free pricing, meaning that, you know, they just released their software for free and that revolutionized their business. And some other people tell me that free never worked for them. They will never do it. From your perspective, what is the kind of the line that you would advise them that go with freemium kind of a strategy versus no, you should just offer a free trial, but don't offer a freemium?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it runs the risk of taking up the rest of our time together because I've got a lot to say on this particular topic. In general, the better answer whenever someone mentions freemium is free trial. Okay, so let's give the rationale for free trial first. Free trials are an excellent idea. Big fan of free trials, right? And they exist not just in software, but, you know, you've got, you walk through the grocery store and someone hands you a little sausage on a toothpick, whatever. We've all experienced this, you know, walk around Costco on a Saturday, whatever it might be. Free samples, free trials, right? There's something about our animal brain that really lights up in a way that it doesn't for just reading. You know, you could have the best copywriters in your company, the best website designers. You've paid the best firms to create explanatory videos of your product and write amazing white papers. But all that engages this intellectual, rational mind to a certain extent. But when we engage in a free trial and we actually try that software, we eat that sausage in Costco, whatever it might be, there's a part of our brain that goes, oh, wait, now I get it. Now I understand how this is so valuable. So this is related to economists classify different goods and services in different ways. And software is in this category of called an experience good, which means that our perception of the value of the thing changes when we experience it. And you may have this, you know, it doesn't have to be in software. It could be getting a haircut. Like, I don't know, I go to a new barber. I don't know what it's going to be like. It says it's $30. I hope he doesn't, you know, hope he doesn't make a mistake. I've got some important meetings next week, whatever it might be. But, you know, it does a good job. My perception of the value of the services change after I'm done, right? And software has the same deal. And so with a free trial, we're able to engage that and have that work for us. Freemium, on the other hand, does not. It does that, but it has a whole bunch of other negative side effects. And it gets taken to an extreme. I think one thing we really have to think through is when we have freemium, going back to this discussion before we had about price is merely how value is divided between a buyer and a seller. If I give you something free, what does that say about how valuable I think what I'm giving you is? It's free forever. Oh, just it's free. Mm-hmm. So we run this extreme risk where we teach our customers that our product doesn't actually have any value. That's a dangerous game. I don't know many people that want to take that on rationally mm-hmm. when it's stated that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about how valuable a thing is, but then you're willing to just give it to me? Like, shouldn't you be, aren't you proud of it? Shouldn't you be willing to charge something for it? I think in many ways, you know, freemium creates this massive illusion. The best kind of metrics I've seen is that about 1-3% of freemium customers convert to paid. So what does that mean in a B2B context, which is mostly where I play? It means that don't adopt a B2C strategy for B2B, because in order for 1-3% to have a meaningful impact on your business, you need a massive market. You need potentially millions mm-hmm. of accounts that could convert in order for that strategy to make sense. That being said, it creates this mirage, this desert illusion in the distance. I know massive respect to any marketers who are listening, CMOs, heads of growth. You have a very, very hard job. I do not envy you at all. Getting new business is tough. Getting new signups, getting those people convert to paid, doing all the work on SEO and paid search and social. So you adopt this freemium approach, and now you've got somewhere between 97 and 99% of your user base that's on the free side. You say, man, we're doing all this work on the social side and paid search. Like, what if we just did a little bit harder to get these folks to convert who are on the free side? Because they're almost there. We just got to get them over a little bit. And so now what ends up happening is a massive investment in, well, like, hey, the free folks say if product just adds this feature, then you know, a bunch of them would actually start paying. Or maybe we need, you know, user research to change sort of the onboarding to make the value more apparent for these folks. Or we will run some more activation campaigns into the base, right? So spin up the marketing team to do this. But it's a mirage. These people will not convert. These are not your people. And so much time and energy and effort is wasted because we run into what is called the penny gap. The penny gap is a term I didn't invent, but it's this idea that when we go from free, we go from 0 to 1 cent, mm-hmm. that is an infinite increase in price.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay? So the activation energy to get someone to convert that penny gap is nearly as much as finding someone off the street and trying to get them to buy your product. Mm-hmm. Like, there's that much of a psychological barrier. And so this whole idea of we're going to get these people, they're going to fall in love with our product, and then they're going to convert, I think is just a massive illusion and causes a bunch of dysfunction in time in mm-hmm. in terms of companies. And I think, you know, ultimately, you know, there's so many other elements to this. I will say there's a couple of very specific cases, exceptions to the case I just rolled out of where freemium may be applicable. as I mentioned before, if you have a colossal market, you've got a very specific competitive environment. I think the darling of freemium world a while ago was Evernote, which competed against Microsoft OneNote. Mm-hmm. Well, if you've got the largest software company in the world that effectively is giving away a directly comparable product in their Microsoft Office bundle, that's not a great business to be in, number one, but you've got very little options, right? It's like, hey, like everyone already has this thing installed. If they have Microsoft Office, like how do we go head to head with that? That's a very specific competitive environment. I don't think most people are in there. Mm-hmm. If the product doesn't show value in a limited time frame, there's a couple of examples of this. Sometimes developer tools, mm-hmm. You know, maybe there's some, you know, whatever developer tool it is, but your engineer on the who's your end customer on the other side, they need to use the product in staging or development for 3, 6, 9 months. They're not trying to run it in production. They're just trying to get the software built and use it. So instead of having free trials and constantly having sales involved, extending keys, you just give them a free version that no one would ever in their right mind run in production because it would just fail because it would hit limits pretty quickly. But it allows that sort of go-to-market motion where the person can actually do their work and not have to constantly be, you know, asking for trial extensions because they're not really in a purchase situation yet because they haven't, you know, at that point, we're talking about aligning the customer when they start getting revenue versus when you're going to get revenue. And so that can help in that situation. And then sometimes in a if there's a built-in community, so I think the ultimate example here is Slack, where they've got more of a cold start problem, almost like a two-sided marketplace. Mm-hmm. And in that case, you don't want to put any barrier. Like the product itself isn't valuable until everyone's using it, right? And so you don't want to get in the way of starting that flywheel of it being used. But so those are a couple of rare exceptions. But like, as I started out, I'll close with what I started out. The better answer, if anyone breathes the word freemium in your company, the better answer is free trial.
Fantastic. No, that's a great point. Now, when it comes to, for example, you know, being transparent with pricing or not, right? So some companies may say the best way for us is to go and just publish the pricing on our website. And some companies say, no, that's actually may work very much against us and we don't do it. Is there any kind of quick answer to that? Or you would say it depends actually if it works for you or works against you if you are transparent and publish your pricing on the website?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So should you have transparent pricing? It depends, but I will tell you what it depends on. So you can make a rational decision for you in your specific situation. So your stats on this are difficult to come by. The best stats I've seen have, unfortunately, a little bit of an error range, but it's about, say, 50 to 75% of B2B SaaS companies have public pricing and packaging. Mm-hmm. And I saw a stat as well that said SaaS unicorns are twice as likely to publish their pricing as non-unicorns. Let me talk about a couple of bad reasons I hear that people choose for not publishing pricing. We're afraid our pricing is too high or too low. Our competitors will get easy access to our pricing information. You know, our pricing doesn't represent our actual price because we discount so much. And I'm sure there's some listener who's like, yeah, that's us. Those reasons signal there are more other significant issues to resolve for your company. Those are symptoms stemming from a lack of a good pricing process, a good value proposition definition, a robust go-to-market strategy or sales process. So you've got this question, you know, those reasons masquerading as like, oh, that's why we don't publish pricing. So that just goes, you know, you should go be laser focused on fixing those because those shouldn't be the reasons you don't. So there's really kind of three models that come up in terms of should we publish pricing and packaging on the website. So the first would be full public pricing and packaging. And that's really best if you've got standardized packaging. You know, so we haven't really delineated all the aspects of packaging, but one of those aspects is what we call offer configurations or bundles. A lot of times in SaaS, we have good, better, best laid out in tiers. But there's many other aspects of packaging here, but just, you know, if you have sort of standardized, you know, good, better, best, right, that's easy for people to consume, right, that makes sense to show. If you've got a horizontal product with, you know, a humongous market and competition, that can make sense. So prime example in that case would be like a lot of the workflow software. If we think about Trello, Asana, Monday.com, you know, these are, everyone could find a reason to have a Kanban or a sprint board, right? It doesn't have to be development teams. It could be, you know, for any project, for anything, really, you could use these products, you know, relatively standardized market, but horizontal. And then a lot of those have also tend to be high volume and velocity or product-led growth models, right? So one of the things we want to also keep in mind is there a competitive pressure that if all of your competitors have public pricing and packaging and you're the odd man out, I think it's a little bit of a fool's errand to think, well, we don't want to show pricing and packaging because then we'll just have our sales team qualify and then we'll be able to show them the right pricing and packaging. The thing is, if all of your competition has public transparent pricing and packaging, you're not going to end up on the short list. Your sales team is never going to be in that conversation because I don't know about you, but anytime I'm shopping for software and it's like, hey, we've got 20 options. 19 of them have public pricing and packaging, so I can make, and one doesn't. It's like the one that doesn't is like, oh, well, forget them. I don't know what they're hiding, but they're hiding something. I'm going to stay away from them because it feels like they're hiding something. So we need to kind of look at the environment we're in as well. So that's if you want full sort of public pricing and packaging. So the other end of the spectrum would be no public pricing or packaging. So that would be best if, for example, you've got more of an enterprise sales motion. If you've got complex packaging that requires a salesperson to walk through, I was dealing with a client once. They had a 50-page price list. It's like you could put that online, but you know, good luck to anyone who actually is trying to interpret that. So, you know, in that case, right, you'd probably just, you know, terrify everyone if you put it up there, right? Or, you know, and there's definitely more consultative type products and services where, you know, you need to have somebody walk you through, like the buyer's just, it's too complex to have someone just, you know, be able to understand it. Or, you know, the third is if there's a high difference in willingness to pay between segments or a small addressable market. Like if your market is just the Fortune 100, like probably don't want public pricing and packaging. It's just not going to make any sense. Right. And then you've got this middle ground of a public display of your packages, but no price levels. So this would be companies, again, who have a good standardized package. Potentially they have good, better, best, but you know, maybe they have, you know, high difference in willingness to pay between segments or small addressable market. And we usually see some amount of hybrid of those approaches because, you know, maybe people have good, better, best, and then enterprise, and then, you know, they've got full transparent pricing for the first three, and then enterprise is like, call us, we'll tell you. So we tend to see those elements thrown, you know, mixed together, but those are kind of the three basic formats and why you might choose one or the other.
Fantastic points. Thank you very much for these clarifications. To be honest with you, for any SaaS company, these are really real questions that everyone would have. So this is great help. Another question I have for you with regard to a very sensitive matter, and that's really how to really raise your price. You know, everybody is very sensitive to that on both sides. If you don't raise your price, then as a vendor, then you are just going to kind of get not enough money. Over time, the value of any currency is going to go down, right? So in reality, $1 doesn't buy you the same thing 10 years from now. So if you don't change your price for 10 years, you are getting less actually. And if you raise your price, we have seen that many, many times in many occasions, then your customer may get annoyed if you don't do it in the right way. So from your perspective, you know, and the vendor may lose actually, even if the price is now higher, but the profit and revenue and everything goes down as a result, or don't get really the support that they need from their customer base. Is there anything that you would say, well, this is the right way to raise your pricing if you want to do it? Or you may say, the risk is much higher, be very cautious. Don't raise your price, just add more customers.
I might have to come back for a second time, Armin, because we're getting in some pretty deep topics here. So I'll give you the overview and sure. We'll see where you want to take it. I think pricing is simple, but it's not easy. For any pricing change, price, and again, I use the term pricing and packaging, we need to evaluate just two things. What is the difference in expected revenue? What is the difference in costs incurred? So we didn't really talk about pricing process at a very high level, but I think at the highest level, we always need to keep in mind, what is our goal as a company? What are we trying to achieve? And then go through those two simple questions. What is our difference in expected revenue? What is our difference in our costs incurred? There's a couple of scenarios where, you know, you might be in a good place to raise price. Let's kind of touch on that first. So prospects don't push back on pricing at all, or customers actively tell you how cheap you are, or you have demonstrable proof of a very high return on investment. So those could all be very clear signals. You know, there's a rule of thumb that I think is more empirical than theoretically grounded. But, you know, if you have win-loss codes, you should see a good, healthy, you know, third of those lost due to price. Mm-hmm. If your lost due to price is at, you know, 1%, right, you've probably got a lot of room to raise prices, right? You might be in good ground to do so. You know, some other areas where, or signals, it might be okay to raise prices. You haven't touched your pricing for years. And we're seeing this a little bit now, because what ended up happening in the last several years, we had COVID, and given the emergency nature, a lot of companies were very public about, hey, we don't want to be seen as profiteers, or as, or, you know, people are already in dire situations with, you know, all the government assistance needed. We don't want to be put people in worse situations. So we're not going to touch prices. That was then quickly met with 50-year high inflation, pretty much across all developed economies. And so you end up seeing now a lot of catching up. But that catch up in some ways, if you look at an annualized basis over like the last 5-10 years, it's kind of right in line in the most cases. It just looks more extreme because people were so hesitant to do it during the pandemic. But that could also be a good reason. Or if you dramatically improve the process or the product, you know, without monetizing. So those are all, you know, generally, I think some signals that it might be okay. You know, what we want to think through is, you know, strategically, right? We've got our, you know, does it feel like it's the right thing to do? Given some of those signals, do we have our goals in line? Have we thought through what our expectations are in terms of revenue and costs, right? It's ultimately driving towards effective long-term profitability. We want to think through a couple of kind of strategic areas. So one, you know, there's the obvious, I think it was the premise of your question. Some customers may churn or feel gouged, right? They may feel, going back to earlier in the conversation, they may feel that this is unfair, the process is unfair, or this is, so we want to be sensitive to that. You know, it could impact potentially your NPS or referral, right? So we want to be sensitive to that and understand where those elements come in. We also want to think through competitive reactions. Yeah, are we in, or also, you know, depending on your leadership position in the market, you know, if the market leader in your category has raised prices, it's sort of given air cover to the rest of the category to also follow and raise prices. So, you know, but also, right, like, you know, price collusion is absolutely illegal and no one should ever collude on prices, but there is a lot of discussion of price signaling, right? If you've got the leader of your category coming out saying, you know, we're committed to whatever, you know, long-term value creation strategy on behalf of our company, right? They're doing that in a way to signal the rest of the market, like, yeah, we could all follow up on prices. But again, depending upon the market you're in, you may have, say, competitors that don't act in a rational fashion, right? So this is some of the things we want to think through. And I think fundamentally, you know, thinking through all those customer reactions, you can never know with absolute certainty how customers will react to a price change. Sure. I think one of the things we want to do is just, you know, especially in a B2B scenario, we really want to think through different customer segments. What customers are currently getting a lot of value and which ones aren't? Which ones are we as a company getting a lot of value from, usually in terms of measured of like lifetime value of that particular type of account? we have a lot of Pareto principle, 80-20 at work in B2B markets, where you know, 20% of our accounts might be 80% of our revenue, right? So, you know, if Netflix changes prices across its customer base, well, everyone pretty much has the same plan, right? There's I don't think there's any enterprise Netflix customer, right? But you might have a Disney or JP Morgan or whoever it might be, right? You're like, oh my God, like if we do it wrong on them, like that's going to be, no one's making their bonuses this year. All right. So we want to think strategically through how do we want to roll this out? Which customers do we want to test first? How do we think about new versus existing accounts? There's a philosophical argument to be had that if you change prices on new business, that really isn't a price change because those people weren't your customers in the first place. So they don't know any better. They're just now they're just coming to buy from you. And like, this is what the price is. But obviously existing customers know very well. So we want to think through that rollout plan, you know, our justification, making sure we're, you know, enabling, you know, if we have a sales team, we want to make sure that marketing is enabling that team with proper justifications, the proper give gets that they can, you know, handle the negotiations appropriately, right? And that there's a clear lines of communication from those frontline folks, you know, whether it's customer success dealing with renewals or this, you know, new business sales folks. We want to make sure that there's a clear back and forth communication to the senior executive team and the pricing committee, if there is a pricing committee, on what is sort of the reaction from the market as these changes are rolling out, so you can make adjustments in real time. So that's a very deep topic. That's my high level answer. But like I said, if we need to come back and have a round two, I'm happy.
No, very insightful. I appreciate it. I know that any of these questions, you know, it's not super easy to really put them in 5 minutes, but you did it, and then very insightful. I appreciate it, Dan. As my last kind of ask for you today, I'm going to ask you if you could, you know, introduce maybe or refer a book that you like personally, you have read it and found it either professionally very useful or, you know, maybe in other ways. Is there any particular book that you might have in mind?
You know, I really liked, I finished a pricing book not too long ago called Getting Price Right by this gentleman named Dr. Jerry Smith. I think he's a professor at Boston University. And very well done. He was a keynote speaker at a Professional Pricing Society conference I went to last year. And he gave this amazing talk with some examples that I still use to this day of, you know, how he used this example of Evian, the water company, how they're able to charge such premium prices in their market. And it just goes back to some of the conversation we had at the beginning, which is, you know, yes, there's art and a science to pricing. And so we need to really understand what's our marginal cost to serve customers and how much does it cost us to acquire customers and what is our overall profitability. But then what I really think I liked about some of his stories from that book was, look, ultimately, there's a lot of leeway in how consumers view the proper, if we are able to set consciously the proper frames that people use to evaluate, to look at the value of our products, right? We can leverage that into extreme success in terms of how we're able to charge for our products. And so it was a fascinating book. So highly recommended that one.
Thank you so much. Again, it was a great discussion. I learned quite a few things and I hope audience enjoyed it as much as I did. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Armin. I enjoyed our conversation as well. Hopefully it was valuable for your audience.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armin Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to saasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's QRVEY.com.